You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite what happened later, in the early 20th century, European Jews found Vienna one of the most tolerant places to live in. The Gallias were a Jewish family who became extremely wealthy and lived on Wohlleben Gasse.
Wohlleben Gasse,
which translates to Good Living Street. That's also the title of Tim Boney-Hady's new book, the one he chose to name his book about the Gallia family, his family. They would eventually escape the Holocaust with their paintings, furniture, and silver to live in Australia. Good Living Street, Portrait of a Patron Family, is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Boney-Hady to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
The cover of the book has a Gustav Klimt portrait of a richly dressed woman with a strong family resemblance to you. It's in the National Gallery in London. Had it remained in the family for a while?
Yeah. They commissioned it probably in 1901, and it was in the first Klimt retrospective in 1903 and in the family's possession from then. In Vienna, ultimately in Good Living Street, in Wohlleben Gasse, and then when they fled as refugees and arrived in Australia in 1939, it was in the family flat in Sydney, and it remained there until 1971.
So you grew up with it?
Yeah, so when I was a little boy, it was in the living room. I could touch it, as I could touch the Hoffman furniture. It was a picture I knew intimately. And then in 1971, when my grandmother and great-aunt had got frail and were moving into nursing homes and hospital bills were rising, it was then sold by Christie's in London and 5 years later ended up in the National Gallery in London.
The family owned a number of paintings by Klimt. Did they all survive the war?
No, they had a big collection of secessionist pictures. There were two Klimts. There was the portrait, which has ended up in London, and at the moment, actually, it's on show in the Belvedere in Vienna. At the same time, they bought one of those beautiful, very modernist Klimt landscapes of a forest interior, of a beech forest. And it was in a consignment which was on its way to Australia, which got as far as Italy, and then Italy entered the war. And that consignment disappeared. So that Klimt painting hasn't been seen since the 1940s.
It's just disappeared into somebody's private collection.
We have no idea. It could have been destroyed or it could be in a private collection.
What about some of the other prominent artists in Vienna at the time, Egon Schiele, Oskar Kokoschka?
They didn't. There was a kind of generation of collectors who began collecting really, I guess, around 1898 or around 1900 when the secession was new. And for them,
the secession was a group that included artists and also art patrons?
The secession was a group which was included artists and architects and designers. People like my great-grandfather Moritz Gallia became kind of founding members of the secession, but the key members were the kind of artist members. Anyway, there was a kind of generation of collectors for whom Klimt was the kind of star artist, and who then also ended up with furniture by Josef Hoffmann and paintings by other secessionist artists. But often with those early collectors, they didn't move on to the next generation of sort of famous Viennese modern painters like Schiele and Kokoschka. So they knew Schiele, they lent paintings to exhibitions which Schiele organized, but they didn't collect him.
Now Hoffman is kind of like an Art Nouveau architect, very prominent during the time.
Yeah.
But he did furniture as well.
That's right. He did buildings and then he did complete interiors. There was an idea of a Gesamt Kunstwerk, an idea which was very powerful then, that you should have a kind of total work of art and that you would have complete interiors designed, and he would do the furniture, the carpets, the wallpapers, the silver. In an apartment like the one which my family had, in a room like the salon, the only thing which wasn't Hoffman was the Steinway grand piano.
Well, we had the same sort of thing in this country with someone like Frank Lloyd Wright.
Absolutely, yeah.
How much did you know about your family before you wrote this book?
Not very much. I had gradually been gearing up about in the early 1990s when my mother was still alive. I had persuaded her, she was actually quite reluctant, to write an extended family memoir.
And why was that?
Why was she reluctant?
It's an interesting
story. Yeah. I think that she'd been in many ways, she'd been born in Vienna in 1922. She'd escaped in 38, 39. In many ways, it was a world she was glad to have escaped, and she found returning to it kind of in print, writing about it, a very difficult kind of thing to do.
And she lived a number of different lives in an odd way. Her name changed three times during her lifetime.
That's right. She's originally Anna. Then her parents separate, and her mother renames her Anna Laura. And then, like a lot of these people, when they come to an Anglo kind of world, comes to Australia, she becomes Anne. Yep.
Anna Laura, to some degree, also because of the changes occurring in Austria, it sounded like a more Christian name.
Yeah.
But we are talking about a family that was largely Catholic, even if it had had Jewish roots.
Very complicated. I mean, they begin being Jews. They many members of the family convert in the early 1900s, which prosperous families often did for a mixture of kind of motives. But then my grandmother marries a Jew, and so my mum is raised as a Jew from 1922 until 38, and then just before they flee, they have her baptized, partly in the hope that it will be some kind of protective measure. So the religious identity is complex, and there are members of the family who begin being Jews, who convert to Catholicism and then revert to Judaism.
And then I've spoken to some people who went to convents because that was a way to protect the child. Who never thought of themselves as Jewish because they grew up in, as Catholics or Protestants. Yep. There are all sorts of different reasons that people converted. But interestingly, your family was able to go to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were trapped in Europe. How did your family wind up in Australia?
They were very lucky. I think partly as a result of their wealth. They had connections with people who had the right kind of power, and they were actually in a position where, an extraordinarily fortunate position, where they got visas both for the United States and for Australia. And I think the reason they made the choice to go to Australia was that one member of the family had already gone there, and then, a bit like sort of chain migration, they wanted to be with family, and so all the later members of the family who could get visas did go to Australia so the family could be together.
My guest is Tim Bonihady. He's written a book called Good Living Street. It's published by Pantheon. Some of the information you get here is from diaries.
Yeah, in my mum's cupboards when she died, there turned out to be fabulous diaries from my great grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother, and they've allowed me to, I guess, recreate the life of one of those Jewish families in Vienna, and then moving forward in a way which maybe hasn't been done before. There's a kind of depth of information of what it was like to live in one of those sort of modern secessionist Hoffman kind of households. What, you know, there's wonderful detail about when they first saw Isadora Duncan dance at the Secession, when they saw Buffalo Bill the last time he came to Vienna with, you know, his full kind of Wild West circus, when they saw Mata Hari for the first time and she takes off all her clothes, the kind of their cultural consumption.
Mata Hari did that?
Yeah, Mata Hari did
that.
The
spy.
Ultimately the spy, before she is a spy. She first comes to Vienna in 1905. And So when they first go, when they go to Mahler premieres, and all that kind of world is all there in these diaries.
Well, this was an incredible time for such a small city like Vienna. Freud is also there. Mahler is there.
Yep.
It had one of the greatest opera houses in the world, one of the greatest concert houses.
It was probably the great opera house, and it was one of the centers of the modern. And I guess my family, as part of being patrons of the modern, loomed quite large in that culture. And
where did the money come from?
It came from gaslighting. You know, there's this period in the late 19th century where there's an extraordinary kind of competition between Edison's electric lights and gas lights, and there's an Austrian inventor called Karl Al von Welsbach, who around 1890 invents the gas mantle. And there's over a decade where the gas mantle, I guess, sort of beats electric lights, and people involved in that industry could grow very rich very fast, which is what the family did.
You mentioned that your grandparents divorced.
They had a very short marriage, yeah.
Would that have been atypical at the time?
It was rare, but not extraordinarily rare. I've encountered lots of people who had short marriages, often produced, you know, one or two children in that period, and then the marriage failed.
And then Gretel and your grandmother and your mother moved back with her parents.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been possible for Gretel to have been able to find an apartment of her own?
Yeah, and she probably could have. I guess the situation of someone like her coming from that kind of family, the idea that she would have worked would have kind of been anathema to her and to her kind of to her society. And the easiest way for her when she became a single mother was to return to the big house in Good Living Street, where my great grandmother then provided governesses and servants and all that kind of apparatus, and I think that was very common.
But your mother remembered her childhood as frustratingly controlled by her grandmother, and then her diaries reveal something very different. This is part of the fascination we have with history. We have our memories of things, and then we have the written record.
Absolutely,
and they don't always jive.
That's right, and that was one of the extraordinary things. I think the most. For me, the most remarkable things in terms of what someone can forget is that she was actually at the Vienna Opera at a performance of the Magic Flute, Mozart's Magic Flute, on Kristallnacht, and she didn't remember that. That in all the other extraordinary events which she went through, that one got lost. So to have been at the opera on that most terrible of nights is something she either suppressed or forgot.
How long after the annexation of Austria did Kristallnacht take place?
It happens on the evening of the 9th of November, the morning. It really happens on the morning of the 10th of November, and the annexation is the middle of March. So that's whatever that is, 8 months after.
Not long after. How long after that did the family seek to leave? Some people stayed way too long and then realized they couldn't leave.
They were lucky. They left 2 days after Kristallnacht, which means that they'd already organized all their departure before. And insofar as my grandmother and great aunt were fortunate to escape with a lot of, not all, but a significant part of the family collection, including the Klimt portrait of my great grandmother, all those things, they were never easy, but they were relatively easy or easier before Kristallnacht. After Kristallnacht, everything got harder, and it kept on getting harder and harder until ultimately it became impossible.
Is it surprising that they were able to leave with so much? Because the Gestapo had come to visit the apartment.
Yeah.
You would have thought many things would have been confiscated.
Yeah, I mean, it's both. One can both explain it, and it's extraordinary. If you were collectors of the modern, you had more chance of taking what you had than if you had old masters. The Nazis were less interested in the modern, and there were certain rules that if you had kind of contemporary art, you could take them. But yet there's a woman called Sophie Lilly who is who's done the greatest work about the looted collections, the looted Jewish collections of Vienna. And when I first saw her in Vienna while I was writing the book, and I explained to her about this collection and how it got to Australia and how it included a Klimt and other paintings and extraordinary Hoffman furniture. While she could help me explain how they managed to do it, she equally had never heard of a story like it. And for her, it was the greatest collection of art and design to escape the Nazis.
Now, you've gone to Vienna.
Many times.
Could other members of your family go there, or was it just too painful to revisit?
No, we began going for the first time in 1971. My brother and I went with my mother. And I think for her, those first few trips, for her, the trips were always hugely complicated because of all those layers of memory and experience. I guess I've had an increasingly rich time as I've written the book, and the book has sort of drawn me and connected me with Vienna in a way I wasn't before.
Well, looking over your background, you're an art historian, a curator, and an environmental lawyer. They don't seem to all go together.
Yeah, that's what I am in Australia.
Director of the Center of Climate Law and Policy at the Australian National University.
Yeah. In Australia, we have what are called combined degrees, where you can do law degrees and arts degrees at the same time. Normally, people who do those really end up specializing in one or the other, but I guess exceptionally have kept them both going. So I've ended up writing a lot of art, sort of cultural history and art history, and curating exhibitions. And I've done a lot of environmental law and climate law as well.
Too bad you weren't able to keep the Klimts in the family.
Well, they're in good homes, and you know, it's nice to see them on display and lots of people enjoying them. I think that's a good fate for a family collection.
Tim Boney-Hady's memoir is called Good Living Street, Portrait of a Patron Family, Vienna 1900. It is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.